911, what's your emergency?
My boyfriend proposed to me.
I'm sorry, is that an emergency?
Yes. I don't love him. I think that's good.
No. What do you think Abby would say in response to that?
Eat your damn nuggets and get off my line.
That is probably what she would say. Well, here we are again, episode 3, Next of Kin.
Welcome back, everybody.
Welcome back to the First Respodcast. I'm Jane Mulcahy. What's your name?
And I am Ryan Kearns. So we put out our first episode a couple of days ago, didn't we?
We did. This is the first episode we're recording since posting. We're like a couple weeks, we're a couple weeks delayed from when we're actually posting the episode. So this is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we want to say thank you guys for all the love on the first episode. And thank you for supporting our pod. And we are looking very forward to covering this entire show in depth.
Yeah, we got comments on Spotify, which I didn't know was a feature of Spotify for podcasts. Coming at you live and from my house.
It's Saturday night.
It's actually Sunday night, but close.
It is the Lord's Day. The Lord's Day. What's up, Bobby?
really, we should be resting right now. It's the day of rest.
Yeah. Shout out to Bobby Nash. We are doing
Resident
him
Catholic.
Proud. Resident Catholic Bobby
Listen,
Nash.
Listen, fellow Irish-American, no doubt, right?
Oh, no doubt. No
Nash
doubt at all.
Nash is an Irish name. And okay, he's an Irish-American from St. Paul, Minnesota. He's just like me, for real.
He's just like you. Yo, wait. Not your cousin.
My cousin. He could be my uncle. Yeah.
Shout out to your uncle. Uncle Nash. Uncle Bobby. Nash,
Uncle Bobby.
He's so dad, though. Like, honestly, I'll just be watching the show, and I'll be like, oh, he's so dad.
He's very dad. Also, though, can you imagine having an uncle who accidentally burned his entire apartment building down, killing his family in the process?
I mean, it would definitely put a damper on family reunions.
It would be like one of the incidents in your family, for sure.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I honestly don't even know how I would deal with that.
Well, it's okay, because he moved to Los Angeles, so he probably never comes to family reunions anymore. That's kind of sad to
That's
think
true.
About. I shouldn't have said that.
No, it's fine. I'm just like wondering, does he have extended family? Because if so, I think
That's
family reunions would be... Or if not, like, I feel like family reunions would be a little lonely.
I feel like a lot of characters on TV shows don't really, like... They kind of conveniently leave out extended family, because that would be a lot. Although, I guess you could say someone like Eddie has extended family. He has, like, his aunts and his grandma and stuff.
But do we ever meet Shannon's family?
No, because why would we? Because the show hates Shannon.
Right. Because Why did I ask?
Her nasty, brutish, and short life didn't even... you know, qualify enough to have any details about it. We meet her mom at one point, briefly, I think, but that's it.
Yeah, maybe she's estranged. Maybe it was like a thing of like she got pregnant and was excommunicated from the family or something. I don't know. Maybe it was...
I have a series of like elaborate Shannon backstory headcanons.
That are all going in your fic. You have to choose one when you write your fic.
I'm not going to write a fic, but I do all of my lore in my head.
Just lore theorizing about Shannon's, like, you need to write something from Shannon's perspective is I think what we're saying.
She has so much to say. She's such a rich character, and the show wasted her.
What was that Toni Morrison quote that's like, if there is a story you want to read and it hasn't yet been written, you must write it?
She probably said something like that. Yeah,
I think I saw that on a sign outside the Strand once, and like, okay, it stuck with me. Okay, should we just dive right into this episode?
We probably should. Season 1, Episode 3, Next of Kin. I was excited to get to this episode because I kind of feel like the first two episodes were largely set up in a way. And I feel like this is one of the first ones where it feels like, okay, we're really like getting into it. Big dramatic character stuff is starting to happen.
Yeah, I definitely got that just from watching. Sorry if you're hearing creaking. I'm lying down my bed. It is creaky as hell. I definitely felt a lot of that. Even just like the way that the episode is structured, with like opening with this sort of whimsical bouncy castle flying away call, with the dad trying to connect with his son, it just felt like very classic 911. It's like when you It's like when you're, it's like you're watching a show and you really like feel it starting to get its groove and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the only thing I can really compare it to is Glee.
Absolutely. If we don't mention Glee for like a certain amount of time, we'll start to slowly die.
Yeah, exactly. Yo, it doesn't talk about Glee for 8 minutes. Like,
this is not the first. Like, I have Glee in my notes later.
Oh, nice. But I was just thinking, like, you know, like in season one, where like the first couple episodes don't really feel like classically, like they're not doing a lot of songs. The character relationships are pretty different. Their mm-hmm. dynamics are not quite as established as they will become. A lot of characters
Acapella
are in the background.
Always strikes me as an episode that's not quite Glee yet, even though I love acapellas. Yeah. Who is Josh Groban? Kill yourself.
I love that line so much.
Truly.
I remember you were saying before you like picked it back up again that like acapellas is the one that you always fell off at.
I feel like it is, but it's weird because I do like that episode.
Maybe it's just the lack of like good songs in that episode, because the only good number in that episode is Bust Your Windows, which is one of the best numbers in the entire
True.
Show.
Are you saying you don't like This Is How We Do It?
All I'm saying is there's a reason they never released it for streaming. Anyways, we open with the bouncy castle.
Yes. This is such an iconic 911 disaster. And also, I wanted to say, although it seems like a silly, whimsical thing, like horrifically, this is a thing that has happened multiple times and like killed children. It's actually really scary. Like, apparently the safest way to use a bouncy castle is like inside, I'm pretty sure. Because yeah, like on windy days, they can do this, which is so crazy.
Yeah, I think I like, okay, there was, I didn't find the clip, so I haven't sent it to you yet, but I will dig it up. There was an English soap opera, I think. No, it was like a low budget English miniseries where was it English or was it Spanish? It was a non-American miniseries. Mm-hmm. that like was all about like this this like bouncy castle that blew away with all these kids inside of it. I mean, like, it should be like super dramatic, but it's like absolutely hilarious because
wait, I have seen this clip. I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah,
it went viral.
I vaguely remember this.
It was so funny. But no, this is a very serious thing that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is dangerous. Just like for people out there, remember to practice safe bouncy castle etiquette.
And when was the last time you were like in a place that like had a, I guess like the answer is like when you were a kid, but like I can't even remember the last time I saw a bouncy castle.
I for some reason I feel like I've been in one like more recently than when I was a kid, but I don't know why I think that. I do think what sucks about bouncy castles having this potentially dangerous element is that bouncy castles are like the most fun thing in the world.
Yeah. Oh yeah, 100%. It's like bouncy castle, one of those blow up slides, and trampoline.
Yeah, which apparently like trampolines are super dangerous too. I always wanted a big trampoline when I was a kid, and my mom like didn't want to get one because they were dangerous, apparently.
Is she who told her that?
I don't know. It's a thing. You're supposed to like dig a pit and put your trampoline into it, I'm pretty sure, if you want to, like, practice
what?
The safest trampoline habits. I know. Obviously, imagine how I felt hearing that as a kid. I was like, Mom, nobody does that.
So, not to give you major childhood FOMO, but I did have a trampoline in my backyard growing up.
It's okay. You can say it.
I loved it so much. We got it used for, like, $100 at this garage sale. Not even 100, it was like 50, but it was something, the springs were in really good condition, the setup was in really good condition, no rusting or anything, and so like every now and again we'd have to like replace the mats or the lining or whatever, but like we just, it had a net and everything, so we wouldn't fall off, and we would just like jump around. I would jump around for literally like hours sometimes.
Yeah,
it was so much fun.
So
and like,
fun.
I was just like,
I loved whenever I would go to a friend's house who had one. All right. Well, the bouncy castle gets uprooted. It's like stakes in the ground come up, partly because an adult was jumping in the bouncy house. Maybe that's part of the danger.
So do we want to explain the context of this scene?
Well, I mean, what context do you need? It's just a birthday party with a bouncy house. But yes, I do want to say a bit about kind of the protagonist of this 911 call.
Right.
Because,
yes.
Yeah, we open on this dad who is kind of trying to get back into his young son's good graces, because it's kind of interesting how much they manage to communicate without a lot of exposition or anything, because you get a very clear sense that this dad has divorced his mother of his son at some point recently, is now apparently married to a kind of younger seeming woman and has a baby. Oh God, she comes over to him with the baby and she's like, will you hold your son for a minute? And he's like, no, I'm going to go play in the bouncy castle with my other kid.
Yeah, wordlessly, completely wordlessly, too, just like blows her off.
Yeah,
and is like, let me go and try and connect with my older son.
That was Eddie Diaz level husband behavior.
Oh my God. They were testing out stuff for his character in this episode. Important context is also that he's like, he's rich and he's splurging on this like birthday party super, super hard, like to the point where like they have like a sushi chef and like, you know, like just like it's really like high class stuff. Like there was like a waitress serving like what I assume are Martinelli's in champagne flutes. Like, and he's talking with his, you know, buddies about like the Santa Ana winds, because in SoCal you get the Santa Ana winds at a certain time of the year.
I thought that was kind of interesting in retrospect, because then in like season six there's like a very dramatic storyline about how the Santa Ana winds are like making everybody crazy.
Yeah, apparently it's like a big thing. I don't know, I'm not from California, so I don't know a lot of like the, I guess, the cultural specifics, but it does seem like the winds cause a lot of problems on this show.
So, yeah, the dad gets into the bouncy house. He starts bouncing. The whole thing gets uprooted, flies away. And the dad falls out of the bouncy house, I think, from up in the air. So he's presumably very injured. And the kids get kind of like stranded on a cliff still inside the bouncy castle, at which point we call 911.
The 118 rolls up. It's like the castle's already stranded. You only get like one shot of it flying away, which I was kind of disappointed by, because like I thought it'd be so funny if they were like driving in the fire truck and they like the they were like trying to catch up to it while it was flying. I don't know, I thought that'd be fun,
but unfortunately the bouncy castle has been grounded by the time the 118 get there, and basically the main thing,
which is totally necessary.
Basically, the main thing we're supposed to get from this call is that Chimney is feeling kind of sidelined. You know, Bobby has Hen and Buck rappel down the cliff, which Chimney wants to do. In his mind, that's like the fun stuff. But Bobby has him work the winch instead. He has a line where he's like, how come I never get to do any of the fun stuff? And Bobby says, working the winch is fun.
Right. And so he's just feeling like, I don't know, like the redheaded stepchild, like the one that's like always like left out of all the fun, like, but like doing all like the manual labor or whatever, just like the really unsexy, unglamorous work. And like, I guess we'll talk about why that's important later on. But it is, I guess it's kind of Chimney's first real moment of narrative attention on the show, which is interesting.
Yeah, this is very much a Chimney episode. In fact, maybe this could be the episode that we title Chimney Sweep.
Oh my God, Chimney Sweep. This is totally the one.
Yeah, this is a good Chimney episode.
This is totally the one.
Another thing I was noticing in this first scene is that we're very much still in that yellow color grade world.
Okay, I noticed that too, and I noticed it with this scene specifically.
Yeah, this what is just like a yellow-ass season.
Yeah, what is up with that?
It's like season four of Teen Wolf when they go to Mexico and suddenly they've just slapped like the yellowest grade over everything.
I was watching this scene and like watching like Buck rescue these kids. I'm like, did they all get jaundice while they were up there? Like, are their livers failing? Like,
something they don't tell you about the Santa Ana winds is they make everything yellow as fuck.
That Coldplay song was inspired by the seasonal weather patterns of Southern California.
Season one of 911. Okay.
It was so all yellow.
They save the day. Everybody survives this call, but Chimney is feeling a little disempowered.
Before we get into Athena's part, I just have to say something really briefly about something that I've noticed about SoCal in general and like things that are set in California, which is that, and this might just be me being a snob because I grew up in the mountains of like the Pacific Northwest, but the cliffs don't look that impressive on this show.
Just negging, right? California's not even like anything they can control, but just the geography.
Seriously, like the geography is like it's like, I'm just like not impressed by it. It's like, I wanted some vertigo. I wanted a sense of like imminent danger, but it looked like there was a path that they could have just like just moseyed on down rather than rappelling down the cliffs like a bunch of, you know, like
I guess
Spider-Men.
Spider bucks. I guess maybe Spider it is bucks. Just, I don't know, maybe if you're in a rescue situation, even if there technically is a way to hike down the mountain, maybe it's just quicker to rappel.
But that's just the thing. I mean, like, is it even a mountain?
I don't know. I mean, it's probably like the, you know, little easy cliffs that you specifically use in Hollywood productions, you know?
I'm sure it is. It's just like, I don't know. It seems like I've never been like really floored by a cliff, not just on like this show, but like on anything really set in like the LA area.
Wow.
I don't know
Ryan
if that
is
observation
not impressed
is anything
by California.
I'm not, honestly. Like, as far as like the West Coast states go, California really has to step it up, because I mean, like, I know it has all like the cultural, I guess, clout or whatever, but when it comes to the actual geography, Washington's give it like a run for its money, you know.
Well, at least you got the first two seasons of Teen Wolf.
True. And at least I have all of Twilight.
Exactly. So then we cut back to the dramatic cliffhanger that we got at the end of the previous episode. Athena discovering her daughter May has overdosed. And this is a very intense emotional sequence. She calls 911. The ambulance gets there. I think it's kind of like supposed to be... Athena kind of thought it was a little worse than it was when she first walked in, which is totally understandable. You know, she freaked out.
Yeah.
But as May is being taken away, it seems like, you know, it doesn't seem like her heart has stopped or anything. It's not looking too bad in terms of May surviving, which she does. They get to the hospital and then we kind of have this sequence with Athena and Michael. They have, I think, some good emotional moments of like kind of blaming themselves and trying to figure out. They both kind of come to the realization that it seems like something bigger is going on with May that they weren't aware of.
Yeah, definitely. They seem like they're really in that element of just like confusion and fear that I feel like a parent in their situation would be feeling. And of course, Michael's obviously blaming himself because he thinks it's about the gay thing, and Athena doesn't really know what to think, but she is kind of blaming herself too, because she sees the hydrocodone bottle and she knows exactly
her pills
where it came
from.
But she knows how many were left, obviously. So she like, I'm not an expert on opium overdoses, of course. I was writing something that involved an opium overdose, and so I was Googling like how many pills to until you die, and like all of the results were just like, help is available.
Yeah, that's one of those things. Well, okay, then there's an interesting moment where Michael is kind of comforting Athena, and who should walk in but Michael's date that he brought there with him. I feel like I'm kind of starting to remember why I didn't like Michael on my first watch through. It's like I had kind of attributed most of it to just that one like biological clock line he has in the first episode, but I'm realizing like there are like multiple moments where it seems like Michael, like, you gotta rein it in a little bit, where it just seems like he's not being the most considerate towards Athena. I get that he, you know, wasn't expecting to get a call that he has to come to the hospital, but I just feel like it's also like, haven't they barely, if not even, I'm not sure they even did like fully decide yet that they're going to get a divorce, and he's already like actively going out on dates.
That's the thing. That's I was cringing so hard for Athena in that situation because like, imagine being her and your newly gay husband is there comforting you, and in should walk the guy that you know he's been seeing, who apparently drove him here and is you know, quote, worried about him and everything. And it's like, I would have, I mean, like, props to her for getting up and walking away. I would have had to be forcibly escorted from the hospital.
Hospital, you're getting a new patient.
Yeah, like, it's Athena, Grant, you are stronger than me, because like I would have pulled out a Glock or something, like, seriously, like.
And you know she's packing, because she's
and
got
you know
that.
She is.
She's got her weapon on her at all times. I'm not trying to be too hard on Michael, But, you know, I realized that he didn't know he would have to come to the hospital, and maybe it makes sense that the guy would have driven him there, but, like, the guy should have left after that. Like, I'm sorry, yeah. But if I'm the date, I would have been like, oh, this is, like, so clearly between you and your wife, and also I know that this is a precarious situation right now where, like, you guys aren't even fully divorced yet or whatever, and she's not even fully accepting of it yet. Like, I should get out of here. But no, for some reason, he has stayed and is just in the hospital hallway, kind of, he doesn't even, like, say a word to Athena or Michael.
No, he just kind of shows up,
kind of stares at them. Oh, man, it's awkward.
It's just, like, I mean, like, he has to know that that's, like, wildly inappropriate, right?
He has to know
that's, like, extremely, like, extremely inappropriate. I get that you're, like, worried for him, but, like, I don't know, call him later or something.
Yeah,
like,
call him later. So
drive
that
away,
was,
like, yeah.
Yeah, so that was one of my first notes, was just all caps, Michael brought his date, ? Poor Athena. Yeah,
dead.
Like you said, she's stronger than us. But then Michael and Athena get to see May, and May kind of explains that she's being bullied at school really badly by some girls, and she didn't want to tell her parents because she's been trying to handle it herself. And we get this great moment where Athena goes, they messed with the wrong family. And Michael also goes, the wrong family. So, of course, I couldn't help but think of the Vivica A. Fox series of Lifetime movies where she ends every movie by doing a title drop where she says in that exact cadence, like, looks like I hired the wrong real estate agent. He was the wrong Mr. Right.
Oh, my God. The 47th Lifetime wrong movie just dropped.
Sounds like you picked the wrong life coach. Yeah.
They picked the wrong family.
The wrong family.
And did. Like, I was honestly really living for Athena in this moment. Because, like, I love it when she goes protective parent mode. I like seeing protective parents, like, stick up for their kids and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like on this watch through, I was actually, the May thing was really resonating with me, because I had, like, when I was in high school, I had a friend group turn on me and bully me a lot.
Oh, no.
And it was, like, just, like, probably, like, one of the worst things that happened to me as a youngster. And it was so hard. And so I was really feeling May's, like, just that helplessness. And I was feeling Athena's anger, too. Like, she does some questionable things about this in this episode and in, like, I think the ensuing episodes. But... Yeah. Even though I think she should not be abusing her power as a cop, I was thinking, like, man, I do get it, because it's like, there's not a lot you can... Bullying is so upsetting because there's really not a lot you can do about it. It's like, even if your school has a policy about it, they might just not follow it, which is what happened in my case. And, you know, as a parent, it's like, it's not like you can, like, send a kid to jail for bullying your daughter, you know? So it's just kind of a lot of frustration that you can't really take out on anything or anyone. So, yeah, I was feeling for both of them.
Yeah, no, like, it's unfortunate that little kids are just such little sociopaths a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But, like, there isn't really a way to get to them while they're still, I guess, capable of righting their wrongs, in a sense.
Right.
Or at least, well, I don't want to be doomerish about it, but...
No, but their brains aren't fully developed, so it's like they don't really grasp that their actions have consequences a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember being, like, the same thing happened to me in grade school, and, like, when, like... I remember being a kid in that moment, and it was, like, being the most isolating, horrible experience ever.
It, like, ruins your life.
It does ruin your life. And, like...
Because, like, that, like, is your whole life as a kid.
Yeah. And, like, when you're a kid, you know, obviously, like, because adults have a different perspective on the world, because they have lived longer and, like, I guess they have a distance from it, you feel like they don't understand, which is why I really like seeing the parents' perspective in this situation.
Yeah.
Because it's showing, like questionable police practices aside, of course, it's showing that they're actually, I guess, doing something about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is validating.
Or at least really wanting to. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's an interesting moment where someone from Child Protective Services comes into the hospital room, and both Athena and Michael are pretty upset, but I don't actually know if this is a thing in real life. I don't know enough about these things to know, but basically they say that anytime a child attempts suicide, you have to like have them be assessed by CPS, which makes sense. But again, I don't know how true that is. And so they can't bring May home that night, which is pretty upsetting for both of them. But Athena, in her Athena way, is like, you gotta let the wheels of justice do their thing. So she allows this to happen.
I also don't know a whole lot about that side of things. I know about, I mean, obviously we know about like the 72-hour psych evaluation hold that hospitals do.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume this is in partnership with that.
This but, is CPS.
Right. And like, it's like thinking like, I get that there would be like, I guess, an external investigation that would have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If we're accepting, I guess, the rules of this reality, obviously we haven't researched this.
Right.
maybe it's just from Angela's performance, which, I mean, like every other episode, but like I was kind of singling it out watching this like as amazing performance in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like feeling really frustrated with the CPS agent. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Obviously, May doesn't want to be separated from her parents. She like is literally saying, Mom, please don't leave me. Like, and
yeah,
you're isolating her when she's in this vulnerable state. It was just infuriating.
Right. I think it's one of those things that in real life I would support, but like the way they frame it on the show, I think very intentionally kind of makes it seem like the CPS lady is, you know, the villain in this situation.
Yeah, there's something sinister about her with the way that she's like, you know what I'm entitled to do if you refuse to cooperate. And it's like,
it's very, I feel like if she was a character in season 7, she would come back later as like a villain who's actually secretly been plotting against Athena the whole time.
Yeah, or season 8.
Stupid. Or season 8. Season 8 is also stupid, but in a much better way.
Much better way. Much more entertaining way, certainly.
Not to get ahead of ourselves or anything.
Yeah. Maybe, that's pretty far down the road.
It is. I was thinking maybe one of these days we could do like a bonus episode or something where we just kind of shoot the shit about our season 8 opinions, because I imagine some people listening probably are keeping up with the show live and like have seen the latest episodes and maybe would be interested in hearing some discussion of that.
That would be a really fun thing to do after we like close out season 1. We finish like our 10th episode and do like a bonus episode like sharing our controversial season 8 opinions.
I don't know if we even have any controversial ones so far besides really wanting Eddie to keep his mustache, which we already know sadly isn't going to happen.
Really wanting the mustache to stay, and also really wanting something else to happen with his character.
We'll see.
But we don't have to talk about
we'll cross
that right
that
now.
Bridge when we get to it.
Oh, Homotron 3000, we love you on this pod.
Okay.
I
so
heard
after,
someone call him that on Twitter, on 911 Twitter, and it just stuck with me.
No, I also saw that.
Athena's going to kill Layla and Georgina.
As she should, queen.
As she should, right?
Well, then we cut right to...
I just wanted to say...
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Oh, so I just wanted to say one last thing about this, which is that I thought it was a very sensitive portrayal of the sort of these problems of, you know, suicide and bullying and everything, especially it being told from May's perspective and from Athena's perspective. Like, it almost felt, and I mean this as a compliment, it almost felt Degrassi in the way that it was really... by the book with it and wasn't sensational in any way.
Yeah, just very sincere and kind of responsible in that wonderful Degrassi way.
Yeah, and like that, and honestly it was really refreshing, because like as much as I do love sensational storytelling, and I think we share an affinity for it, when it's not the focus of the show or when it's not like the highlight of the show or anything, it feels good to know that people are taking steps to treat the subject with care.
Yeah, and actually something I used to think about this show before season 7 is that what I always really loved about it is that although the like 911 call side of the show and the, I guess you could say, the external conflicts a lot of the time were really crazy and over the top, the character stuff and the human drama always felt really kind of grounded and real to me, like very... Even if, again, the external conflicts are crazy, like, you know, what happens to Chimney in this episode or whatever. But the actual kind of internal stuff that's going on with the characters always felt very real and believable. And now I'm not sure that's quite as much the case anymore, but it's something I
we're
love
in season
about
one.
These early seasons, exactly.
Yeah, no, no, yeah, we're in season one, we're in season one. Yeah, no, I guess a way that you could say is like the stakes are highly sensational, but the emotion is very, very sincere.
Yeah. So then we cut to the wonderful Chimney and Tatiana. Honestly, watching this episode back, kind of an iconic couple.
Very much so.
As much as I will come to love Madney, something about the camp of Chimney and Tatiana, like, I was kind of obsessed with them this episode. We cut to Chimney and Tatiana. Chimney is preparing, quote unquote, an elaborate meal, but he is clearly reheating food that Bobby has actually prepared for him. There's kind of a bizarre, like, blocking moment that I think maybe was kind of a mistake, where he takes a pan of something out of the oven and the pan of food looks totally fine, but then he, like, dumps it in the trash. Like, yeah. I imagine what it was in the script, or like what the director intended, was like, oh, he's burned something in the oven, so he throws it out. But for whatever reason, the way they've actually staged it, it's just like totally normal looking food. So you're
yeah,
like,
it
why
just
is
looked
he
like
throwing
perfectly
that in the
like
trash?
Golden crisped home fries. Like, it's
yeah,
like,
and then he and, just dumps
but then
them
he
in the
wafts
garbage.
The scent over to her, which is
right,
like,
so it's like,
because
what
she
was,
says it smells great.
What was the idea there? Not sure.
I mean, like, I guess we got what was right with, like, I guess the chicken wings or whatever he was like taking out of the Tupperware.
I think he's making like lamb shanks or something, or whatever that's called, or pork chops or something.
I love a lamb shank.
They were definitely on a bone.
Right.
Yeah, so he's like microwaving stuff, but he's clearly passing it off as his own. Tatiana's like sitting in the other room and he's like, don't come in here because I can't have anybody messing with my process.
And then they do dinner.
He's also lying about what he did on the job. He's saying he was the one rappelling down and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And we see more of Tatiana as we established in episode one. They met on romancingtheuniform.com.
Romancing the Uniform.
We see more of that here, where she's like, is it bad that the hearing you say you rappelled down the mountain, like, turns me on so much?
Bobby says she has a hero fetish. He uses those words.
Which it does seem like she has.
She does. I mean, like, you have this, like, great moment where she lists two things about Chimney. She says, you can cook, you rappel down mountains to save kids, you're a keeper. And it's like, those are the two things he lied about this episode.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's like, wow. Oh. And then tragically, he proposes to her.
Yes, he proposes to her. It just feels so bizarre, because you kind of get the impression that they probably haven't been in a relationship for that long.
Yeah.
Which makes it all the more
painful. I was
going
to ask that, like, how long do you think they've been together?
I got the impression, kind of partly from her reaction, it kind of seems like this was only like a middle serious relationship, you know?
Yeah.
And so she kind of immediately is like, I can't believe this is happening. She says to him, I really was not expecting this. I wish you'd asked me about it first. And he is like, what, you wanted to ask me to ask you to marry me? And she's like, well, yeah, that is how most people do it. She clearly was super blindsided by this. And she basically tells him, like, I don't really want to break up, but I also definitely need some time to think about this. And she says, oh, this was my glee note. She says this crazy thing where she's like, I was engaged once and I cheated on him right before the wedding because of my, you know, attachment issues or something.
Yeah.
And I wrote down, this is so Terry Schuster coded to me.
Oh my God.
Like, something about the way she delivered that line and like the content of the line just felt like something Terry Schuster would say.
Right. Right. It was like if Terry was being proposed to by the coach instead of Miss Pillsbury.
Right.
That's hilarious. That's literally hilarious.
It was kind of funny because I feel like usually the dialogue on this show, even when it's like jokey or silly, doesn't quite hit that level of like satire that I feel like you see on Glee, but that was like one line that felt like it could have been interchangeable with a Glee line to me.
Well, this goes to show, I mean, just how much they knew each other, because Chim didn't even know that she was engaged before.
Right. I also thought that was crazy.
He didn't know that she was engaged, and then it turns out not only was she engaged, she cheated on her fiance, and right, she only likes wedding. You for things you're lying about. It's like, I mean, like, loneliness is such like a crazy killer, because like any person of sound mind and body would be able to tell that this is not not only just like not a good relationship, I mean, they're just like not compatible on any level.
No.
Right? We get the next scene. It's a hard cut to Hen and Buck at the firehouse playing like a knockoff GTA. It's like I guess about firefighters.
Yeah, simulator.
Yeah, a firefighter simulator that seems to use all of the low-res, like, knockoff assets of GTA 5, which is set in, like, Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And Buck says, you know, Buck runs over someone, and Hen's like, oh, you know, you lose points if you, like, kill someone on the way to a call. And he goes, and he says this fantastic line. He goes, he'll be fine. It's just a flesh wound. You know, Obamacare.
Good old Buck.
Good old Buck. Oh, Oliver Stark. He is like an underrated comedic genius, in my opinion.
No, honestly. So good.
His timing is just like absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. No, I loved the cut to them playing video games. I like this idea that like Hen and Buck are kind of buddies, even though like Buck has not had his full redemption yet, really.
They're what?
I didn't say anything. I did not.
No, I like the idea
that even though he hasn't quite had his full, like, redemption come into himself yet, I like that, like, she kind of has a soft spot for him.
Yeah. I mean, because, like, she's so, like, big sister to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in a lot of ways. Like, she, because Buck is so just, like, the kid brother of, like, the group. And, like, yeah. And then Bobby's, I guess, the group dad and everything. But, like, I don't know. They just, like, they are really underrated friends. I remember seeing, like, a thread of that on Twitter. And I think, oh, by the way, this is just a sidebar. This is Aisha Hines' first episode wearing her fabulous, fabulous glasses.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Finally.
And we have been waiting. Honestly, I think that's what makes this episode feel like proper 911.
Right.
And glasses.
Just having her glasses. Yeah. Just I like having the moments. Her glasses. I like that. There's a moment in season 6, I think, when Buck and Hen are like both off work and they get really drunk together, and
yeah,
I just remember that's a great episode. I think they have great chemistry,
and Aisha Hines is honestly such a charismatic actress that I feel like everything mm-hmm. I've seen her in, she's had chemistry with like all of her scene partners, so I think that's
she
just
even
a real
had chemistry with Dennis and Dee Reynolds in that one episode of It's Always Sunny where she plays the welfare caseworker.
Oh, major chemistry. Major chemistry.
So Buck and Hen are playing right. their video games when Chimney comes yeah. in looking very upset, not really looking yeah. himself. And, you know, the gang coaxes out of him that he tried to propose to Tatiana and it didn't go well. And Bobby kind of starts judging him for it and
yeah.
doing his little Bobby thing where he doesn't overtly say it, but he's kind of implying that he thinks it's good that Tatiana said no. And Chimney really, you know, Chimney's not having it today. So he really takes him to task on it. And he's like, no, Bobby, like, say what you mean. You're looking at me with that little smirk on your face.
Mm-hmm.
I love mm-hmm. that line because it's like, finally, someone is acknowledging Bobby always having a little smirk on his face.
He does always have a little smirk on his face. It's like he thinks whatever he's saying is absolutely hilarious.
Even when he's saying very not hilarious things. I swear, in episode 1, when he's like talking that woman down from the ledge, he has the little smirk on his face.
Yeah.
I just have written down his performance is amazing. I don't even know why I wrote that down for this scene in particular. Compared to everything else he does.
What I was finding interesting about this scene, having watched the rest of the show, is that Chimney is kind of putting in all these little digs that Chimney has no way of knowing this, but he's really getting at some of Bobby's trauma. You know, he's yeah. saying, I've never met your wife and kids. He's saying, you know, I feel sorry for your wife because she has to put up with you. And, you know, he obviously doesn't know yet that Bobby's family is dead. And Bobby has a lot of trauma related to that. So I, you know, his performance, you could say, is interesting here because the actor no doubt already knows that about his character. And you can kind of look for clues in the way he reacts.
Oh, definitely. Like, I mean, he brings up the little book and everything.
So Chimney storms out and he's like, I'm going to go get some air. He goes for a drive. Not a good idea, given what happens next. He goes for a drive. And I have to bring up the Final Destination series again, because this was reminding me so much of the opening of Final Destination 2. The logging truck, like, you know, impales people with the logs. But this was kind of an interesting, like, reversal on that, because at first you're getting the truck with the rebar in it driving ahead of Chimney, and you're like, oh god, this is going to be a Final Destination thing. But then Chimney actually pulls ahead of the truck, and then he has to, like, swerve off the road because there's, like, some shrapnel in the road, and comes to a stop. The rebar truck is for some reason not able to come to a stop fast enough, rear ends him really hard, so it's like the truck hits him from the back as opposed to the stuff going through his windshield from the front. So maybe an intentional reversal of the Final Destination 2 opening.
I think that'd be iconic if it was. Because we know Tim Minear likes to base storylines off of movies.
It's true.
And he likes to play with that. The thing about this scene that bothers me is that it's filmed and it's shot in such a way where there were multiple points when I just asked myself, Chimney, why can you not just, like, go around this guy?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I get that he's going 80 miles per hour, but it's like,
I feel like they were trying to communicate that whenever he would try to, like, get around him, the other car would also, like, go the same way. But, you know, it's like, why would the car be doing that?
Right. I mean, it's they didn't construct, I guess, a scenario where that was warranted. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't see why the truck would be constantly cutting him off unless the driver have beef.
It's kind of like the thing where he throws away the perfectly good potatoes earlier. I'm almost like, is it like a direction thing? Like, are we witnessing a not great directed episode?
I think we might be because obviously
I don't want to say that because this episode was directed by a woman and we stan female directors.
Oh, we do stan female directors.
So
I can't say anything.
As you know, feminism is all about blindly believing that every woman is perfect.
Right. Ann Coulter, goddess, diva.
Goddess.
You know.
Anyway.
What's her name? Candace Owens. Yep.
Candace Owens. Let's not bring Candace Owens into it.
Let's leave Candace Owens out of this.
For once. Chimney gets, like, crashed into by this truck, and the 118 gets called. Bobby gets the call. They go to the scene, and Bobby is told to prepare himself to see the state that Chimney is in. And we soon see that the reason for that is that Chimney has a big old piece of rebar stuck through his skull, like through the back of his car seat, through his skull. And Chimney is not aware of this. He can't feel it.
He can't feel anything. It's literally like it's lodged not just through his skull, but also through his car. So he's pinned. He can't move.
Yeah.
And he has no idea why. Obviously, he can move his toes. He doesn't have any physical ailments because of this. It's just that
it's like
gone
through the exact right part of his brain for him to not really be able to register that it's there.
Yeah. It's like Floyd Collins, but more. Wait. No, not Floyd. Not Floyd Collins. Floyd Collins was the sand cave guy.
Yeah, you're thinking of... I know who you're talking about because I've gotten a couple comments. Yes, I've gotten a couple comments from people on my video saying, oh, it sounds like that was inspired by the guy who got a pole through his head. But I will say...
that's exactly what it was.
I had heard of that guy. It didn't occur to me while I was writing the video. The only thing is, I've heard that guy, like, his personality did change after the pole thing happened to him, which is pretty different. You know, the whole thing with Chimney that I find so funny about this incident is, like, spoiler alert, but, like, nothing. He suffers no long-term consequences from getting rebar through his skull.
It's a little, you know, it's episode. A literal medical miracle.
Yeah, there's a great clip I put in the video. It's like his doctor is looking at his scans a few months after Chimney has recovered, and he's like, I've never seen anything like it in my whole career. You're a right. modern medical miracle.
Yeah. Which isn't that so much fun? Isn't that so much fun when like shows can just write around medical issues by having the doctor be astounded?
They do the same thing with Buck's leg later in the show. They have him at like a follow-up appointment and the doctor's just like, yeah, I can't believe it, but you're totally fine.
when Chim, I guess like one of the biggest things that you maybe consider is that like the rebar is sticking out of his skull far enough that you would maybe expect him to be able to see it. And so they also write around that by saying, well, I don't know what he can see. Right. And they just don't have him react to it.
It is fair. Like if you've got a piece of rebar through your skull, like, yeah, it could be affecting your ocular stuff. But yeah, basically Chimney doesn't know. So the 118 kind of go over to assess the situation. Bobby ends up showing him. He like takes a video of Chimney and shows it to him.
Right.
So funny. Because Chimney, they don't want to show him, but Chimney's like, no, I really need to see this. So I had never really registered this detail before, that they take him to the hospital just still in the car because they don't want
to. Oh, yeah. They just like, they basically tow his car to the hospital.
It's kind of weird though, because they tow his car to the hospital and then right outside the hospital, they finally cut him out, which I guess maybe they just didn't want to risk like doing that and then traveling with him. But I'm like, what difference does it really make?
I guess it would be safer to do near the hospital. If things do go wrong.
I guess. You'd think that, like, once you get him out of the car, you'd think you would have a better time, like, being able to stabilize him once you get him out of the car, than as opposed to, like, having him on a rickety, like, you know, bumpy tow truck all the way to the hospital. I don't know.
Right. It's like, what if they hit a pothole? You know what I mean?
Right. Like the ambulance is kind of built to have injured people in it, whereas like the car is just out in the open on the tow truck with nothing to protect him.
But if they cut him out of the car, then then we wouldn't get that amazing line where he's like, it can be salvaged.
Buck says, yeah, you can probably buff that out.
Yeah, I will say the prosthetic work here is fantastic because all these effects are practical, and it's a really cool way to show off your practical effects by taking a on-set cell phone video and using it in the episode.
That occurred to me too. Yeah,
it's like it's kind of like they're bragging a little bit.
Yeah, like, oh, this is really in the room with us.
Yeah, and honestly, it's like really cool to see because like I don't know, it's just a weird way of like putting you in like the direct perspective of the character. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's not super common on these shows, so I appreciate it when it happens.
In season two when they are responding to that influencer who's live streaming, and like Buck and Eddie find the camera and we see them on the live stream with the chat.
OMG, they're so cute. They should totally be a couple.
Anyway, not to get ahead of ourselves.
Not to get ahead of ourselves. But so then we get kind of a little montage. I just wanted to say before we get to the hospital that I've had headaches that feel like this.
I believe it. We've all been here, really.
Also, while they were driving down the freeway, I don't know if this is just the show's magic working on me, but like the budget for this show right out the gate was fantastic.
It's impressive that they look like they're in real environments so often.
Yeah, real environments in like LA too, which is like, I know it's like cheaper to film than traveling, but like you're in a major metropolitan area, you're gonna...
Yeah.
I don't know how much of this was filmed on site. I can't imagine they had an easy time actually shutting down the freeway if that was what they were trying to do. But
sometimes I feel kind of stupid about like movie and TV sets. Like I can very much be fooled by a soundstage. So I don't really know like what to look for.
Right. But that's like the budget showing through because even if it wasn't that big, they used it smartly. But Ryan Murphy's shows
are... Yeah, even if some things are on a set, it's like if it looks good enough to fool you, then that's a really good set.
Yeah, that's the thing about Ryan Murphy Productions, the studio, the production company, is that all of their shows look fantastic, and they all have their own visual identity, which even is definitely appreciable.
Not always so much going on upstairs.
Right, right. At least it's always like glossy and gives you something to look at, which, you know, if you're working with a sort of a show like this, which is, you know, on a lot of levels kind of popcorn entertainment.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just want to look at something that is compelling on its own merits. But they get to the hospital, and this is a very difficult moment of like, our job ends here, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, yeah, Buck wants to go through again, and we get kind of a montage of sorts where you know, we're in the hospital room, the OR, whatever, as Jimmy is having the rebar taken out of his skull.
The OR. You do love Grey's Anatomy.
I love Grey's Anatomy, seen every single episode. And so, yeah, this is a little bit of insider knowledge, but sometimes they call the operating room the OR. Yeah, we see them operating on Chimney, and we're sort of intercutting with members of the 118 back at the firehouse, like, you know, distractedly trying to do their jobs, but they're just so upset about Chimney. And then we do kind of a hard cut to Abby, who I had almost forgotten was on the show at this point.
Like 25 minutes into the episode, we get Abby's first scene that where she's not, I guess, responding to the call.
I thought the structure of this one was kind of interesting in that way, because yeah, we're doing sort of like longer sequences on each character, as opposed to like the typical very snappy like ABC plot kind of six act structure thing. We do this hard cut to Abby and her family. Abby and like her siblings, it looks like maybe a couple of her nieces and nephews, are celebrating Abby's mom's birthday. And this is kind of to show us that Abby's mom's condition is deteriorating. She's becoming more confused. She's kind of less aware of who she is, her surroundings. Like, I found it kind of good. They, you know, one of her kids has gotten her a gift, and it's like her favorite perfume that she's worn all her life. And she opens it and she's like, what the hell is this?
She's like, I don't wear perfume. And so, like, you can see she's like getting kind of irritable too. Her personality is changing a little bit. And then and Abby spritzes it on her hand, and like has her smell it. And you see this like moment of like sort of confused, sort of lost recognition, where you see like the wheels turning in her mind, and something shifts in her brain. And she suddenly forgotten that, I guess, like what's even happening. Like, is it my birthday? Like, she says, like, who's, is someone having a birthday? You know?
But they do say that like olfactory memory is like one of the strongest like memory triggers, like smell. So I liked
that. The sense memory.
When they, when they have her sniff it, and then like, that look gets on her face. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, very subtle. And it's like, again, it's a very understated portrayal of Alzheimer's, which is appreciated. As, you know, we've seen a lot of media that has given a very, I have to come clean about this. The reason I'm like praising the understated performance or the portrayal
of
Alzheimer's.
Is it because of Grey's Anatomy?
No, it's not because of Grey's. I mean, I like the portrayals on Grey's, the various portrayals.
I thought you were about to like be like, you know, the reason I stopped watching Grey's Anatomy or something is because it was bad about that.
Oh, no, 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 absolutely not. The reason I stopped watching is because the plane crash happened and I got bored. No, it's because I saw The Notebook on Broadway. And obviously it was written to be this way, and I thought the actors did a great job with the material, but the material in The Notebook on Broadway in the portrayal of Alzheimer's is very over the top. It is very, I mean, it's, you know, it's a play, right? It's a musical. It's going to be theatrical, but it just felt, I don't want to say dishonest, because obviously there are parts of Alzheimer's, especially late stage dementia, where people can get very confused, very disoriented, to the point of like getting like, you know, fearful and violent, and, you know, that sort of thing. It's just like there wasn't any subtlety in that portrayal. And so to go from that to this, it's like night and day.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me that The Notebook, the musical, is not the most nuanced depiction of Alzheimer's.
Right, right.
But I haven't watched it, so...
This may shock you. Did you see the film, The Notebook?
I never have. I know of it, but yeah, I never watched it.
I feel like it was just overhyped. That's the only thing.
Well, I love a good James Marsden moment. I love a good Rachel McAdams moment. So Abby talks to her brother. She apparently has a brother. Yes. And
Matt.
They bring up Tommy again. And I like wrote in my notes, I wrote every time they mention Tommy, ... damn you, Ryan. Because now I'm like, I am the one trying to get us to stop referencing this, and now it's all I can think about.
I mean, listen, all I'm saying is sometimes your man leaves you for another man, and that's okay. Like,
so has Abby like, just always had a thing for younger men?
I think Abby's always had a thing for men who like men.
That could be a type. Anyway, they mentioned Tommy, you know, the brother is implying that she's really put her life on hold. I actually liked this a lot where the brother is kind of saying all these things like, come on, like, be serious. Like, you ended up taking care of mom because you got the short end of the stick. And Abby is very adamant about how, like, no, I chose to do this because I wanted to do this for my mom. And, like, you know, she's kind of offended by her brother saying these things. It kind of seems like she has taken on more responsibility and the brother doesn't, maybe did not feel as much like social pressure to do that.
Absolutely.
Is recommending to her, he's trying to get Abby to think about putting their mom in a home, basically.
Mm-hmm. which obviously Abby, you know, Abby's very reluctant to do. Mm-hmm. And like, you kind of understand her reluctance because obviously as her primary caretaker, she feels this immense sense of responsibility for her mother. As her daughter, she feels in a sense of responsibility for her. And also she would feel very guilty because, you know, the reputation these sorts of homes have for handling their clients, or I guess their patients. But also, I guess, just the stigma or the shame associated with that, of feeling like, you know, I've failed as a caretaker and I haven't been able to provide for this person who provided for me my whole life.
There's a whole thing around like, oh, you put your parents in a home, you must not love them or whatever. When, you know, to be very fair to Abby, I feel like she ultimately does decide not to do it. But I want to say, you know, I think there's probably, especially in situations where like this, where someone like needs a lot of extra care for something like Alzheimer's, I don't think there's any shame in like looking into options like that, as long as it's a good facility.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah I don't think there should be any shame with that.
Doesn't feel. And unfortunately, kind of the message of the episode is that it is bad to put your loved one with Alzheimer's into a home.
That's the conclusion she reaches. I don't know that the show is necessarily endorsing that.
I'm not saying they're endorsing it, but I feel like that's kind of the vibe you get from having a narrative like that, where like the brother comes in and he's being insensitive. Mm. I guess I'm not giving them enough credit. They're plenty nuanced about it. Like when Carla shows up later and she and Abby have a talk about it, Carla does make a point of saying like, oh yeah, that's a good place. It's hard to get in there. They're good. Yeah.
I mean that's fair. I think it's fair that maybe they could have, I guess, given more voice to not only the good that would do for Abby's mother, whose name is escaping me at the moment. What's your mom's name again? Is it
That is a good question.
I think it starts with a D, but I could be wrong. Not only just the good that it could do for her, but also the good that it could do for Abby, you know, like mm-hmm. Matt
really has
says
put her life
in there,
on hold.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Matt says that, like, you know, Abby, you know, is, or like, some, he says something along the lines of like, you know, you're suffering, this is not a healthy way to live. And that's like obviously objectively true, even if he says a lot of other stuff that is pretty out of line.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the only reason I really get sort of frustrated with Abby as a character is that for a lot of the season, she doesn't really, I guess, stop and take what she herself needs into consideration. Or maybe she is, and she's just like pushing it down, or she's like setting it to the side because she feels this righteous sense of urgency to take care of her mother, which is admirable. It's definitely not inadmirable, but I don't know, like I, as someone who really enjoys her storyline and enjoys Connie and enjoys this character, I really wish she would just take a moment to put herself first. And obviously she's created a scenario in which she can't do that, but it's sad. It's sad to watch.
Yeah, I think it seems like it's maybe a matter of honestly just like self-esteem in this part of her story. Like, it seems like she's kind of been doing this for so long that she doesn't even really think about herself. And it's interesting that you say that, because I think at a certain point, like, that neglect of yourself can actually become kind of like self-absorbed in its own way, if that makes sense. It's like sometimes not taking care of yourself is like actually the selfish thing to do, if that makes sense. I don't even know what absolutely. I'm saying, but I feel like she's becoming self-destructive by like being so selfless.
Well, it's like, what kind of caretaker are you going to be if you don't have any of yourself to bring to the table, right?
Right. Like, or like, is this really what your parent would want for you right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. When they're in their right state of mind, would they really want you to be putting your own life on hold for so long to take care of them as they continue to deteriorate, mm-hmm. and also to have you witness firsthand every single step in their deterioration? I certainly wouldn't want that for my child.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents maybe feel that way as they get older. I don't know. Basically, Abby needs to get a little self-respect. And luckily for her, she will gain that by the end of the season by getting a hot young boyfriend.
Exactly. And then leaving him at the airport to go travel the world.
Exactly. It's just like the end of that movie, The Kissing Booth. So, back to the 118. They get a call. Let's just not dwell on that. The 118 gets a call to respond to a like truck that appears to be full of people. And basically, it's one of those things where some people were trying to cross the border illegally and did one of those things where I guess you pay to like get transported in a truck, like as cargo. And they've been like left in the truck in the heat. So somebody called 911. They get there. It's a very like grave, sad scene to see. They open up this truck. There are all these people who have been there with no water in this hot environment for who knows how long. There's like a kid who has stopped breathing that they resuscitate.
They pry open the door and there's this kid who stopped breathing. There's all these people who are obviously suffering from heat stroke and they do CPR and... meanwhile, Hen is sort of investigating the truck, and she sees the guy's license up on the roof of the truck. His name is Art Guile, which is I don't know, that name stuck out to me because it's like, who on earth is named Art Guile? It's interesting seeing this scenario where this coyote is transferring immigrants across the border in the back of this truck, and that becoming a central piece of this section of the episode. I can't think of another show that does that.
Well, you know what I liked about this scene is, for some reason, I guess maybe just coming off of like doing this analysis of the propaganda on the show, I feel like I was kind of grateful that the show didn't take any stance against, well, it doesn't really take any like moral stance about these people doing this, but it very much shows them as just victims of this kind of predatory situation, and you know, the only bad guy in the scene is the truck driver. And I feel like, I don't know, I just feel like sometimes this show can be, even if it is being sympathetic to something like that, it will also be very by the book. And like, you know, I could see like an alternate version of this where they're like, but people really shouldn't cross the border illegally.
Right.
So I was glad to see that this was just like a compassionate take on that. And what I really liked is, it's interesting, the scene opens with, you know, Buck says something about like, oh, is it bad that I'm just glad to be responding to a call to like get my mind off chimney? And Hen says, you know, we're not here to blow off steam. But then once she spots the truck driver, she like full on tackles him.
Tackles and performs a citizen's arrest, essentially.
Yeah, which struck me as like definitely more of a Buck move. Typically, you know, he's usually the one tackling people. So then Buck says to her, you know, I thought we weren't here to blow off steam. So I like that as a moment, because it's kind of unusual for her.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, she goes,
you know what you can blow.
I wrote down that line. And I wrote, what did she mean by that?
Oh, I was just thinking,
is she saying suck my dick? Because that's kind of a weird way of putting it, I feel like.
I think that's what she was saying. I think it was like clunky dialogue, but I think that's definitely what she was driving at. I was just thinking like, Hen, if you only knew what this man was capable of down the line.
Jesus. Let's
take that out of it. I similarly had like an interesting sort of reaction to this scene, which was, I guess my first thought was, I hope and pray that this isn't going to be like a storyline of they rescue these people and they all get deported. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, obviously the cops are there with them, and obviously, you know, California is a sanctuary state. So it's like, it was written into state law, I think a year before this show aired, that, that it is illegal for, local, law enforcement to do those sorts of, deportation activities, mm-hmm. you know, arresting people based on immigration status, reporting them to ICE, that sort of thing. And so California is a sanctuary state. And so like it happened like a year before that. So it was a very fresh thing. And
yeah.
I guess seeing that with the way that the people in the truck are so, I guess, I mean, obviously the primary concern is, you know, with their son and everything who's not mm-hmm. breathing. But like, I guess on another show, you would maybe expect a bit of hesitancy with, you know, law enforcement or anyone perceived as adjacent to law enforcement, like firefighters or paramedics. And the show didn't even, I guess, give voice to that idea, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like it's part of the show's messaging in a way, is that they want to make their first responders look like, you know, like an ultimate force for good in every way.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, they wouldn't have characters question that at all, maybe. No, I mean, I am glad we're not watching like Blue Bloods, you know what I mean?
Blue Bloods is always your go-to. I think I've seen one episode of it.
So I haven't even really watched it. I had just like heard that it was kind of one of the worse propaganda shows and that it typically is one of the more conservative ones. So I decided to look up like one scene from it because I wanted to pull some footage for my video. I found a scene from the very first episode of the show. I think I might have mentioned this to you. It is like a fan, because a thing on this show is it's like about a family of cops and they have these family dinners all the time. So it's like a family dinner scene from the first episode. And it's like the like woke daughter of the family is disagreeing with Mustache Man, Tom Selleck, about torture, the ethics of torture. And, you know, they're trying to frame her as like the kind of stupid woke lady. And she's saying, I don't like torture. And then Tom Selleck basically goes, well, honey, it's a lot more complicated than that. And torture is good. Our military is justified in using torture. And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. what is this? What am I watching?
What year did the show come out? It was the first episode,
right?
Like it was
2010.
The pilot.
It's not very old.
This was after Abu Ghraib and they were doing this on TV?
Yes, but let me look up exactly what year.
Oh my God.
Yeah, 2010. Holy shit.
Jesus Christ.
Abby calls Buck on this call. Once again, while he is on a call, he picks up the phone to talk to Abby. And I love the way she's so like, you're on a call. Like, you shouldn't even be talking to me. Like, you don't have to talk to me right now.
Yeah.
It's
adorable. I thought it was absolutely adorable.
Mm-hmm. And we get one of my favorite Buck lines here where he says, I don't know a lot. Which, you know, he does finish that sentence. He says, like, I don't know a lot, but I do know this. But I prefer to just cut it off after he says, I don't know a lot.
Just end it there. That just tells you everything you need to know.
It's more accurate, I would say. And also, something I found funny about this scene is Buck gives Abby, like, the most generic advice ever. You know, like, she's just sharing her struggle with feeling conflicted about putting her mother in a home, and Buck just says something. He's like, I don't know a lot, but if there's anything I've learned this week, it's that family is the most important thing. It's like the most generic thing he could have possibly said, but Abby is so clearly like into him that she just like, she's like, wow, he's so wise. When you kind of have like the blinders on because you really like a person, and it's like, yeah, everything they say is so intelligent.
Yeah. Rachel with Jesse in season 2 of Glee, after he comes back, after failing out of UCLA.
But it's like clear that, to me at least, that what Buck said was like so unprofound And that tickled me. I liked that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, he's not a very profound guy.
Right? So... he doesn't know a lot. So then we get a scene that I really like where Bobby actually visits Tatiana, Chimney's not fiancé.
Not fiancé.
And Bobby is trying to convince Tatiana to come see Chimney in the hospital because Chimney, we've learned, has been put into a medically induced coma. And Bobby just believes that maybe if Tatiana could show up, you know, it would kind of will Chimney to live a little more. And Tatiana, I think, very interestingly and, you know, in a way that I empathized with, actually, is like, listen, I'm not that into this guy. And I kind of am worried that if I stick around, like, you know, there's no way for me to win here. Like, if I leave now, everybody's going to think I'm a bitch. And if I leave later, everybody's going to think I'm a bitch. Like, how, if I go support him now, like, to what end? How long am I going to be by his side pretending to be, like, his perfect girlfriend when I know that's not really the way I feel? And I just found this, like, really nuanced and interesting. And I was definitely, like, on her side in the conversation. I kind of did feel like Bobby was guilt tripping her a little, and I liked that she just stood her ground. To be honest, even if Chimney was like the greatest guy in the world, I still think she has the right to just be like, you know, I'm not in love with him, and I don't want to pretend I am, and I don't want to like get locked into this situation where I'm going to kind of be expected to act a certain way, and I won't really feel like I have the freedom to leave.
Yeah, seriously. No, I was really feeling for her in that moment because it was like there were these two men who were putting her in these very, you know, challenging situations where, you know, Chimney's proposing to her and she has to look like an asshole for saying no or say yes and then break his heart down the line. And now Bobby's sitting here saying, we need you to come to the hospital, not for you or for, or even necessarily for him, but for us, because we want him back. You know what I mean? Now she has to deal with not only do I have to go play, I think she says, like, I have to play Florence Nightingale for this man that I don't love.
She says, she says, if I act like anything less than Florence Nightingale, like, everybody's going to think I suck.
Yeah. No, seriously. And that's totally what would happen. That's totally what would happen.
Yeah.
And kind of what does end up happening. I mean, like, you can totally see Bobby. Like, I mean, he says he's not judging their relationship and, you know, all that stuff. But it's
like, he kind of is.
But he is. He totally is. He's got that judgmental little smirk.
Judging me with that smirk on your face.
As much as, like, a part of me does want to say it was self-centered to, you know, be, like, thinking about herself primarily in that moment and not, you know, this person who clearly has, you know, feelings for her and who she's in a relationship with of some kind. Mm-hmm. And sort of center herself in that moment. I also think that, like, there are moments where you kind of do need to put yourself first and you kind of do need to be the asshole in that situation, you know?
I know. It's like, it's a shitty situation and it's not that Chimney deserves it, but I also think, like, she has the right to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And she absolutely does. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that is when, right after that, we get the first little glimpse of kind of what Athena is cooking up. We just see this brief scene of her outside May's school in her car, and she is like full on stalking the girls who bullied May, which again full is kind of understandable.
Them. And she's identifying them with the yearbook from presumably the previous year. And so a good little attention to detail is that apparently what they did to justify having both of the girls' pictures in frame next to each other is they gave them both last names that began with C, and like C, and like one was like CO and the other was CR, so they were right next to each other in the yearbook. And
That's probably why they're friends.
Yeah, it probably was. I just thought it was like kind of like a little genius moment of like attention to detail, like, oh yeah, they totally would be right next to each other in the yearbook. And then they can have their pictures next to it. Whoa. And that's them there.
The mastermind Tanya was like, hey, girl, you're right next to me in the yearbook, which means you're my new best friend. It's like Heathers or something. Like, right. Presumably they're all friends because their names are all Heather. She's right. Like, I only make friends with girls whose names are next to mine in the yearbook.
So what was Athena cooking? That's the question.
Well, basically just we get the sense that she is plotting some sort of revenge against these girls, which is kind of ominous since she's a grown officer of the law and they are like 15. I do understand like the fury there. I understand why she feels like she needs to do something.
Yeah, no, it's emotionally justified in the narrative. It's just... it's what's interesting to me is that we spend so much time with Athena and Michael and May at the beginning of the episode, and then the whole rest of the episode happens, and we only get this one little moment towards the end with Athena laying the seeds for the rest of this storyline down the road. And
right. Again, it's kind of an interestingly formatted episode.
It is. It is an interestingly formatted episode, and it's kind of like they shoved all of the May stuff at the front, and we only got just like a taste, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But then afterwards, we are back in the hospital. Chim is being taken out of his induced coma. Buck is being adorable.
Basically just in the background of this scene, but I'm glad you I'm glad you said it, sure. Bobby is kind of being the one to like hold Chimney's hand, and it's kind of nice because, you know, they never made up after their little moment earlier because they haven't gotten a chance to. Chimney immediately got rebar through his skull, but you know, I think Bobby maybe is feeling like he wants to make more of an effort with Chimney, so Bobby is really the one to be right by his side as he's waking up. And you know, they all kind of establish that they're his family since, you know, Tatiana couldn't be there. They also have a line about like, oh, I tried to get in touch with your parents, but, you know, they're over in Korea and they couldn't be here. So I noted that this was like one of the first big found family moments on the show. And it's very explicit about it.
Yeah. In many ways, it's kind of the thesis of the show. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, it is like the first one of the first big found family moments. And the first one where you really feel this sort of real sort of deep sense of like care between these people, you know, it's a very beautifully done scene. It's very it's very tasteful in sort of the way that it's written, and also just in the performances are very, very effective. Everyone's very emotional, and like, even though we've only been with these people for three episodes, you know, you sort of really feel yourself get reeled in by just how deeply they care for each other and very sincerely care for each other. And like, that's, I feel like, a real strength of this show is just like the sincerity of the emotions. And like, I feel like a lot of shows are afraid to do something like this because it's melodramatic and it's, you know, it's,
and
I guess,
so what if it is
cringe in some ways. But like, I don't know, emotions are all cringe because they're emotional, right?
Yeah, you can't help it. Sincerity is gonna feel a little hokey at times, and maybe that's okay.
Yeah, I think sincerity is a great thing, and it's honestly like one of the things that I love the most about this show is just how these characters basically, I guess, suck the souls out of each other by just how much they love each other, you know? And so
that's an interesting way of putting it.
No, but like, but you know what I mean, right? Like, do you know
not
what I mean?
Really.
Or am I not,
what do you mean they suck the souls out of each other?
Like I mean, like, you know, you see, like, you know, them like sort of on the verge of tears and everything, and like Bobby's holding his hand, and it's a level of care and sincerity that like I feel like most other shows would reserve for like a season finale.
That's a good point.
And it's episode three. It's
911's like, this is just any old Monday for us.
Seriously, it is. And like, there's so many more moments of that like this throughout the show, that because the show is so unashamed and unafraid to go there, it allows you to feel the same way about the characters as well.
And that's just where the episode leaves us, just with that. Yeah, and I think really setting the tone for the entire, like you said, part of the kind of thesis of the show, that like the 118 is a family and mm-hmm. sometimes family is not who you're actually related to or whatnot, but the people you find and choose in your life.
It's honestly, it's like kind of rare for me to get like really invested in like a found family story. I don't know.
I hear a lot of people like raving about that as a genre, and I feel like it's never really been something that I've been like even aware of as like a genre to seek out, but yeah. I do think it's an appealing part of this show. This might be a hot take, but I feel like maybe when people say found family, like often what they really mean is just like any piece of media that has like a lot of characters with nice, strong relationships. And I feel like you could say that like any good show probably has that. And
yeah.
It's interesting to me that it's become like a genre. Like, I get it. And I also think for a lot of people, it's like most people have some kind of strained relationship with maybe like some family members or whatever. And it's cathartic to see examples of how, yeah, you can forge really strong bonds with people you're not related to. Like, that's one thing I appreciate about that element of the show, I guess, is like, sometimes when you see a lot of characters on this show have difficult relationships with their parents, I think that resonates a lot of the time. Yeah. It's interesting that found family has become such a buzzword, because I almost feel like it's like almost like a meaningless genre. But I yeah. don't want the found family crowd to come at me for saying that.
Well, I feel like it's like there are so many different types of found family things that it's like, well, I don't know, what kind of found family viewer are you? Are you like Heartstopper or like HBO's Band of Brothers? Like, like what's your, or like, are
like
you
Entourage
like
or something?
Or like more like a Sailor Moon type beat? Like, what's your found family of choice?
Ours is what's your found family?
What's your found family? I guess ours would be the 118.
Yeah.
Or the Glee Club, for that matter.
But yeah, it feels like when people say that, what they really mean is I like shows where like the characters are really likable and they're all friends or something. And again, right. I feel like that's a lot of shows.
It's a lot of shows. Also, I feel like a lot of found family stuff, like actual like stuff where they say like we're a family and like that stuff. They have some of the most toxic relationship drama you've ever seen on television, you know, like
or in some cases it's like on 911, some of these relationships are just literal family. Like,
yeah,
like later on when like Maddie is introduced, or like when, you know, two characters get married, it's like, no, you're just like family. Yeah. Family. There's found family, but there's also just regular family.
So do you want to do like a final reflections on this episode? Do you have any final reflections or thoughts about it?
Sure. I mean, I think like we've already said, I think it's a good one. It's got kind of an interesting structure, but I will say as I was watching it earlier today, like I thought it just flew by. So I think it's still an effective structure, effective pacing. And like mm-hmm. I said, I'm just kind of excited to be in the part of the show when like big things are happening, big changes are happening. We've kind of finally gotten most of our characters set up, and like now we can really just have fun in the world.
Yeah, I guess the only character we have left to set up is Hen.
Yeah, yeah. We got more of her this episode, but yeah, she's definitely still probably the person we know the least about.
We haven't met Karen yet. We haven't met Danny yet. We haven't met Eva yet. And so that's coming down the line. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert. I am definitely, I'm really, really looking forward to especially the next episode, because mm-hmm. episode 4 is probably one of my favorite. It was definitely probably my favorite early episode.
Yeah,
if I remember it correctly. It's a huge one, and it's one of the ones that I was watching where I just like really fell in love with the show when I was first watching it. So I'm excited to cover it next week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, good episode.
Right. So, back at you.
No, what a way to wrap it up. But like, good episode. Yeah.
Good job us.
Good job us. If you want to follow us on social media, on Twitter, I am at Dan, Dirty. And on Instagram, I'm at Prime Minister of Sadness. I'm fine.
I'm on Twitter at Jane_Mulcahy. I do not give out my Instagram because it doesn't matter. Don't even ask me what my handle is. And excitingly, I finally made this podcast a Twitter. You can follow us at First Respodcast. The good thing about having picked such a dumb name for this podcast is that, like, none of the usernames are taken. So I was, like, making some of our accounts, and I was like, oh, this is easy. Like, I don't even have to put in any numbers or anything.
Yeah, so follow us on Twitter at First Risk Podcast. I think we're going to be doing
the Twitter just as, like, our outlet for all things 911, because I feel
that would
like
be smart.
We could, like, live tweet the episodes maybe as they're airing.
Yeah. We'll have to sign them, like, with our initials, though, so people know who's tweeting, so we don't misattribute any quotes to anyone.
Yeah, so that we can be very clear about who's saying what.
On Twitter, I tend to have a bit of a more confrontational personality, so I'm going to try and leave that out of our brandable stuff.
Okay. Yeah, we need to be very brandable, and we need to be thinking about clout and how we can make money off of this.
Oliver Stark is not going to come on our podcast if we're getting in fights with fans all the time.
Yeah.
If you like our podcast and you want to support us directly, you can always drop a little rating. I think they do on Spotify and Apple.
It's such an effective call to action when we don't even know exactly what the action is that we're calling people to
do. Yeah, there's an action in there. Would love it if you did it.
Rate us 5 stars. Tell your friends.
And apparently you can
on
comment
Spotify, you
as
can
well.
Leave comments. Yeah, we didn't even know that until today. So
thank you for those who have already commented. And thank you for those who will. Who are listening to this now, I see you, and I know you, and I love you.
And with that, I bid you good night.
Good night. Do not go gentle into that good night. Bye-bye.